originating from our Jimmy John's of Lexington studios. This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Sabre wins the Derby for Todd Fletcher.
Basalt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And Dialed In never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Now here's Jude Feld.
Good evening, everyone, wherever you may be. Trainer Talk is on the air. Tonight's broadcast, sponsored by Fasig Tipton, is the show that trainers listen to. This is Jude Feld, and I'm absolutely delighted to spend the next hour with our special guest and you. Tonight's trainer grew up in Alabama. At this taping, she has won 661 races in her career, including the 2009 Sentient Jet Breeders' Cup Sprint with Dancing in Silks, and Grade 1 victories with Neshoba's Key, and most recently, Bolo. Her trainees have amassed $30 million in purse earnings, and we've been friends a long time. I can tell you from personal experience, she has always been among the most talented and classiest people in our sport. Welcome to Trainer Talk, Carla Gaines. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Thanks for having me, Jim.
Alabama, huh? You and the late, great Cotton Tinsley.
Yeah, a long migration, but the weather brought me to the West Coast for training.
Yeah, the weather cannot be beaten, that's for sure. Where did your love of horses come from?
It basically started when I was, as they say in Alabama, knee-high to a grasshopper. I was probably, I don't even know. Really, I have pictures though of me riding a horse with my mother back when I was like 3 years old.
So it started when you were just a very young kid. Your mom was a horsewoman?
She really wasn't. We lived in the city, but my grandparents also lived in the city, but they had a farm out in rural Alabama in Autauga County. So he had, my grandfather had a couple of horses. A Tennessee walking horse actually was first horse I ever rode. He had a couple of ponies. So that's kind of, we would just go to the farm on the weekends and, he had a lake and horses and all kinds of, he had cows and pigs and all that kind of stuff. So I used to love to go there on the weekends. Was it keep my fingers and toes crossed every week that I was going to be able to go out to the farm for the weekend.
That's great. I know that feeling. My mom had a friend who had a farm out in the sticks in California, and this lady's daughters used to take me on horseback rides, and I would be the same way every weekend. I'd just go, oh, can we go to Louise's? Can we go to Louise's?
I know. It's like you'd be so disappointed if you didn't get to go.
Yeah, yeah. It's a big deal when you're a kid. I remember the first time I got on a horse, I was in my glory. That was just fantastic. Later on, the horses didn't like it when I got on them.
Oh, you have to talk a little bit louder. For some reason, I'm having a little trouble hearing you.
Okay. All right. I'll pick it up a little bit. Your bio on CarlaGainesRacing.com, written by Chris McGrath, is outstanding. It's probably the best trainer bio I've ever seen on a website. And it's not your typical trainer bio. You had a unique path to the racetrack. Talk about your life a little bit and how you got there. I mean, you've done some amazing things in your life.
Well, I don't know about that, but I was never, really meant to be a horse trainer, quite honestly. Anything but, ballet lessons, piano lessons, modeling lessons. My mother had done some modeling when she was younger. So, being from the South, there were certain expectations of women, and those were the sort of things that they were directing me towards. Also, the piano. I had to practice the piano for 1 hour before I could go ride my horse. And so they were trying to do everything to steer me in a different direction. But basically, I just grew up with a real, real connection with horses. And it sort of stuck with me through all those times. And then when it came to going to school, I was sent off to, that was probably another mistake they made. They sent me to my freshman year of college. I attended a private school in Virginia that had jumping as a curriculum, physical education, part of the physical education you could take. Jumping horses. So naturally that's what I did. And so I just continued even through college with my love of riding horses. And, I was very, very, very interested in psychology, sociology. And what it really wanted at that time in my life, I really wanted to do something to improve humanity and our existence here on earth. And I wanted to be in a profession to help people. And so I went through undergraduate school. I went to University of Alabama and then graduated and went on to get my master's in counseling and guidance, and really wanted to go further and get my PhD, but wanted to sort of work in an environment. I'd always gone to school and never worked in an environment that had to do with sociology, psychology. And so my first job, I had to search high and low for a position. That was during a time that's, I'm so old, okay? But it was during a time when, there was a certain percentage of government jobs available, and they had this, there was a racial quota. There were certain jobs were given to different races because they were trying to equalize the labor force in the United States and give minorities an opportunity to get jobs that, had the same education as I. And so, it was tough. But I did get a job finally, a rural county in Birmingham, outside of Birmingham, Alabama, working with juvenile delinquents. And it opened my eyes. I mean, I realized that maybe I wasn't cut out for that work. I was really losing a lot of faith in humanity after spending some time doing that. Just, I didn't realize how cruel people could be to their own people. And basically, back then, that was a million years ago, there was no family counseling, quite honestly, when it came to kids that were in trouble. Back then it was against the law to skip school or run away from home. I don't even know if that's actually an issue anymore, but I got very involved with a lot of kids who were abused sexually, physically, by their parents, by their relatives. It was pretty heartbreaking, to be quite honest. I had been raised in such a great environment. I didn't realize how people treated their children. I mean, not that everybody does that, but that was the sector of society I was working with. So I decided I really needed a break from that work, that particular line of work, and I decided to just take a sabbatical and work with horses for a year because they were basically my love, and I just needed some refreshing I was had totally intended to go back into psychology in some other field. And just basically, as I always say, I was bitten by the bug and never went back to psychology, basically.
Well, I'm sure that you've found your training and experience useful on the backside, because there's a lot of people on the backside that need help and need someone like you that's, you know, quiet and calm and relaxed and can look at it in a different point of view. So maybe you know, that was actually your true calling, to become a trainer and help all of those people. It is a kind of a shock to the system to find out that the world isn't exactly as you see it, and find out that some people have just tremendous obstacles to overcome in their life.
Yeah, and it's, you know, you don't really realize it. I can remember going back to my parents and saying, look, I am so sorry for any and all of the bad stuff that I did growing up, because I didn't realize really how good I had it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It's eye opening. That's for sure. So you got away from it for a little bit, thinking you were going to go back, and you started working with yearlings and pin hooking.
Yes, I had some friends that I had ridden show horses with, you know, during high school and in college, and they had connected up with Mason Grassley, actually, who I think he still works for Fazek Tipton in Louisiana. But hopefully he does. I haven't talked to him in many, many, many years. But we got a group together. I had never been to a horse race. I obviously watched, you know, the Derby and the Triple Crown and all that on TV, and always was infatuated with it. But had actually never been close up to a quote unquote racehorse. So. I had nothing to do with the purchase of the horses, but they bought just a group of very, you know, relatively inexpensive yearlings, and they took them to a farm down in Louisiana, and the name of the farm was Rosalie Plantation, and that's where I began my start with breaking, you know, young racehorses to resell as two-year-old training prospects. So that's how that all started. So we spent my first winter I spent in Louisiana, and realized if I was going to continue in the game, I wanted to go where the weather was a bit nicer, because we were riding every day in, like, you know, sleet and rain. And yeah, it was pretty miserable. But yeah. So that's basically how I first dipped my toe into the industry. But, you know, fell in love with it. Actually, the first racehorse I broke was a horse called Jose Ben, who ended up that year being one of the top two-year-olds in the United States. And so, you know, of course, I thought I had all kinds of stuff to do with that. So.
I remember that horse. He was a really good horse, Jose Ben.
He was a really good horse, yeah. And that was my baby. That was the one that I brought along from, you know, lunging him to the sales. And so that was pretty exciting.
So did you have to be trained to break horses? I mean, that wasn't something that you did on your grandfather's farm or anything, was it?
Oh, yeah. I had a very good friend who lived outside of Birmingham, Alabama, back when I was, you know, working as a psychologist. And he was kind of a different, eccentric sort. He would go to Louisiana and claim very inexpensive broodmares. And I don't remember the price, but I don't know how cheaply they ran them, but he would claim them at the bottom, you know, bring them back to his farm in Alabama and breed them to his Arabian stallion.
Hmm.
So he basically raised Anglo Arabs, and so I broke his horses for him. I mean, he literally had a herd. You can imagine.
So he sold them to people for riding and
experience breaking horses, huh?
He sold them to people for riding and that type of thing.
Yes, yeah. Yes, show horses, jumpers, that sort of thing.
Right, right.
I had always ridden jumpers, or let me say hunters, basically, growing up in junior high, high school. But the showing aspect of it was just always not exactly my cup of tea. I didn't come from a family that would buy me really, really expensive, you know, already made show horses. My dad, you know, we'd just go buy inexpensive horses that I would have to, myself and my trainer would turn into, you know, show horses. One time I had an Appaloosa.
Oh, really?
For a while in the South, it became, you know, very popular to have Appaloosa jumpers. So, you know, I mean, he bought me an Appaloosa one time for like, I don't even remember how much, like $1,000 or something. And I ended up training it to show over jumps, you know, later. So, yeah, I had a lot of that's what I enjoyed the most. That's what I'm trying to say, blah, is that's where I got my joy, was even way back then training a horse to do something that it had never done before, if you know what I mean. I didn't want to get all dressed up and go in the show ring and go over jumps that someone else had trained the horse to do. I wanted to do that. I would rather be the trainer.
Right. So you know, early on, you had that training gene, so to speak, in you. That's what you wanted.
Early on, yeah.
Yeah, that's great. If you joined us late, this is Trainer Talk, and we're talking with trainer Carla Gaines on the Horse Racing Radio Network. So who got you hooked on the racing part of it?
Well, it sort of started, you know, pin hooking those yearlings, and then having my first racehorse I ever sat on being one of the best two-year-olds that year in the United States. And from that, I worked the sales. You know, I worked the yearling sales. I worked in Saratoga, Kentucky. I worked for Lee Eaton. Just kind of all over the map. Just enjoyed traveling and going to the races in these various places, because I'd actually never been to races growing up. And that's actually, you know, after college. So it just was a, you know, basic migration. I did the sales at Hollywood Park way back when that was a very premier sale, and went in partnership with, back in the day, with Mr. Vanberg, Jack Vanberg. So we sort of got connected selling two-year-olds, and then I ended up, after the sales, God, it's almost hard for me to remember how I got into racing. I'm so old. I'm a dinosaur.
You're not that old.
You know, but I mean, I started galloping horses for Jack. And, you know, when it got my galloping license, and then I started doing sales on my own. Started, you know, being a consigner, like in the Northern California sales. And then that's when I first hooked up with Mr. Harris, John Harris of Harris Farms here in California. A great, great person, and, you know, a great California breeder. And just decided one day, you know, then I worked as an assistant trainer for a decade for various people in Northern California and some in Southern California, and then just decided I was going to, you know, go out on my own. And I had, you know, I'd had certain people like Mr. Harris, Brian Sweeney, Mr. Williamson. I just asked them for a horse, and like I got horses that no one else wanted, basically. Like Mr. Harris, he was like, oh, hey, this is great. We found a dumping ground for horses that nobody else wants to train. So that's kind of how I got my start. You know, I won my first race. I couldn't tell you what year it was, but with a $4,000 claimer. It was a non-winners of two lifetime at Vallejo County Fair up in Northern California. And, you know, you would have thought I'd won the Breeders' Cup. It's my first horse I ever started, and he won.
Yeah, I can tell you a little bit about that horse because I had something to do with that horse. I'm at Sanity.
You did?
I did. And when I was doing research for this show, and I found out, I pulled up his lifetime past performances.
Glory Quest.
So it was probably right before you got your license, and I'm standing outside my barn watching a horse that I had just breezed, and Dan Stathatos, who I'm sure you met at least.
Yeah.
He's walking around the barn area with this cute little chestnut horse, and you know,
with
Dan,
what?
A cute little chestnut horse, and he's walking around, and you know, Dan, he always had the patches on his elbows and very, very proper guy, and he's walking around with this horse on the end of the shank, and I said, Dan, what's up? And he said, oh, dude, I got this horse, and I gave him to Charlie Whittingham, and Charlie said it was the slowest horse he ever had. And so I gave him to John Russell, and John Russell said he was a bum. He's never going to win a race. And he pawned him off on Richard Cross, and Richard Cross said, I can't do anything with this horse. And he goes, I don't want to give up on him. Well, I had lost a horse for $10,000 the day before, and I had an empty stall. I said, well, do you want to give him to me? And he goes, after all that, you'll take him? I said, yeah, I'll take him. I'll try him. I'll see what I can do with him. So, you know, with Charlie and John Russell and Richard Cross, this horse was fit to go in the San Juan Capistrano, you know. So I just ponied him for a couple weeks and breezed him a couple times light, and I entered him, and he ran fourth, and I entered him back, and he wins. And I ended up winning three races with that horse, and Eddie Gregson claimed him off of me to give him to Melanie McDonald for Harris Farms. They were going to send her some horses at Turf Paradise. So and then I noticed in the form that you know, you eventually ended up with the horse, and you won with him first time out off a layoff. So we have something in common. We are able to train horses that Charlie Whittingham and John Russell couldn't do anything with.
Well, I remember it was the first horse I had, and I was so proud of him, and he was so beautiful.
He was.
And I think when I had gotten him, he had sustained a pretty severe, by the time I got him anyway, and he'd been turned out, he sustained a pretty severe suspensory injury. And, you know, I was freelance galloping. I was galloping horses for Chuck Genda, and I had my horse down at the end of Chuck's barn. And so, you know, I'd gallop my horses, come back, clean a stall, go back, gallop a horse, come back, ice his legs. And, you know, I mean, he was my first horse. I just adored him, and he just looked so beautiful. And one day I'm sitting on him at the gap at Bay Meadows, just, you know, he's just sitting there. We're watching the horses gallop by, and Greg Gilchrist rides by on his pony. And at that time, Greg was the premier trainer for Mr. Harris. He had some really, really nice horses for Harris Ranch at the time. And he rode by and waved, and then he was on his pony, stopped, and he did a double take looking at me. And he comes back over, and I'm sitting on Glory, and I'm so proud of it, you know. And Greg says, is that Glory Quest? And I'm like, yeah, thinking he's going to go, wow, he looks great. And he goes, I told Mr. Harris to get rid of that SOB 5 years ago. I mean, he couldn't even believe that the horse was in training. And it just, like, ruined my day. I almost wanted to cry because I thought he was going to tell me, oh, man, he looks great.
Well,
I can't really say what he said.
Yeah,
I can
imagine. Yeah, well, maybe you and I are the only fans of that horse, but Melanie won one race with them. Greg didn't win any races with them. So there's only three of us that have that talent. So
Hidden talent.
I love that horse. I've told that story more times in my life because I just think it's so funny. And
know, that's that's hysterical that you and I, you know, that's funny. Because I had no idea. All I know is that nobody else wanted the horse.
Yeah.
That's how I got him.
Well, I just felt sorry for Dan because he's walking around, he's starting to sweat, you know, and he's got this horse. And what's he can't take him home and put him in his backyard. What's he going to do with them? I said, oh, give him to him.
Yeah.
I'll take him. And it was so funny. Aww. He was on a trip to Hong Kong because, you know, he had that craft store and he would go buy baskets and stuff all over Asia and whatever. And he was gone and the horse paid like $43 when he won.
Wow.
It was kind of funny. But, yeah, I love that horse. I thought he was really cute. He was a really good looking horse. He had big rear end. He was by Bull Tropic, who Charlie used to train. I imagine that's how he ended up with them in the first place.
Yeah, he was a beautiful horse. Yeah. Beautiful horse.
Yeah. So we have fond memories of Glory Quest, even if everybody else doesn't.
I know.
It's a cool horse. So you worked for Mike Hart too. He was a really good guy. I really enjoyed being around him. He was a lot of fun. You worked for quite a few people. You must have picked up some tips from these guys over the years.
Yeah, I worked for several different people. Yeah, and learned quite a bit. And eventually, yeah, hopefully that I'm sure that helped me somewhat.
Yeah. Well, it's great to have that experience and the background with a lot of different viewpoints, and you never know what you're gonna pick up and incorporate into what you do now. So,
yeah,
it's pretty cool. Well, we're almost close to our break right now, and we'll take a couple of minutes and pay the bills, etc., and then we'll come back and talk more to Carla Gaines about all the things that she's done, some of the fantastic horses she's developed over the years. This is Jude Feld, and you're listening to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton.
Calling all racehorse owners. Nominations are now open for the Fasig Tipton July Selected Horses of Racing Age Sale. Delivering record results to sellers, this sale has quickly established itself as the nation's premier Horses of Racing Age Sale. Fueled by 28 horses selling for $100,000 or more, including the $700,000 sale topper My Miss Tappet. Last year's sale achieved a record gross and produced an average price of more than $90,000. Race to the top of the market. The Fasig Tipton July Selected Horses of Racing Age Sale. July 8th in Lexington, Kentucky.
Attention, Kentucky breds. Make plans to race at the upcoming Kentucky Downs meet starting August 31st, where Kentucky breds compete for huge purses. Kentucky breds will run for $130,000 in maiden events, with allowance races offering up to $145,000, the highest in the nation. With just 5 days of racing, showcasing 14 stakes races and 4 graded stakes, with additional purse money available for KTDF eligible horses, Kentucky Downs is the place to race a Kentucky bred this summer. Visit KentuckyBred.org for details.
In the morning, I'm always looking for talent. With Always Dreaming, it was always about his athleticism. He's like a halfback. When he hit that hole, he exploded and hit another gear. In my experience, horses like Always Dreaming, they stamp their offspring with that ability. I'm racing with Bruno, and this breeding season, I'm Always Dreaming.
Bloom Racing. Started by former jockey and 35-year racing industry veteran Jeffrey Bloom, Bloom Racing offers racing partnerships, bloodstock services, pinhooking, and private race management.
Pulling away from Come Dancing, Mopetism, and the others, Midnight Bizou leaves no doubt today. She won the Phipps in hand.
Experience the fun, excitement, and exclusive access of racehorse ownership with Bloom Racing. Forming racing partnerships now. Get in on the action at bloomracing.com.
I'm here with Dr. Jim Chiappetta of Flair Equine Nasal Strips. Jim, will the strips make my horse go faster?
The reality is, there's nothing out there that's going to turn a $10,000 claimer into a graded stakes winner. But what we should think about, NASCAR figured out long ago, incremental improvements collectively provide improved performance. That's one area where a Flair strip can help. They're part of the toolkit that many trainers use to make marginal gains for overall improvement in health and performance.
Learn more at flairstrips.com/learn.
This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Bolo, Ohio comes to tackle him. Sharp Samurai in the blue blinkers. River Boyne down at the rail. Catapult swings into action. Delta Prince has too much to do. There's an eighth of a mile to go. Bolo keeps on going. River Boyne on the inside. Catapult far outside. Bowie zero. But Bolo has something left for the final 16th. And it's going to be Bolo coast to coast in the Shoemaker Mile. Tight photo for second. Either River Boyne or an oncoming Bowie zero. Three-way photo behind them. Sharp Samurai, Catapult, or Delta Prince.
Welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton. This is Jude Feld with our special guest, Trainer Carla Gaines. I want to remind you that if you missed any portion of this show, it will be archived on our website, horseracingradio.net, and is also available at Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes. Well, Carla, Bolo, what a tremendous story. Tell us about his career.
Tell you what?
Tell us about his career.
Well, he, we purchased him in a group of horses from Spendthrift, and basically, I don't want to say they were culled, but they kind of were. One of my great friends and owners, Keith Brackpool, was I don't know what position you would say he had, but basically he was in charge of Santa Anita over a five-year period. And one of the things that were noted, you know, was the shortage of horses here on the West Coast. It seemed like, you know, after the recession, the breeding industry took a pretty good hit. We had less foals born on a national level, but it seemed particularly that way in California. So we went to looking to buy horses to help fill the population here on the West Coast and to do some work with some breeders. And I've trained horses for Spendthrift for many years, and we talked to them, and we bought a group of horses. And Temple City, that was his first crop. Bolo was out of his first crop. And so he hadn't really done anything as a stallion at that stage. And I can't even recall what the price would be for the single horse. But so that's how we sort of ended up with Bolo. And he just turned out to be an extraordinarily good horse. And that was very lucky on our part, you know. I had intended on keeping him on the grass, but then, as all owners like to do, they want to try their three-year-olds on the dirt, even if they've been grass horses, to see how they would fare. And he ran really, really well against some of the best horses out here on the West Coast in some of the preps for the Derby. He was third in the Santa Anita Derby. So he was third in the San Felipe. He gained enough points to go to the Derby, so that's the direction we took. And it didn't work out so well, but you never know. So we took a swing at it. And then we came back and went back to the grass, and he had some physical issues, and we gave him time off and, you know, brought him back as an older horse. He just didn't seem to fare very well on the Eastern turf courses. He really, really likes a firm, firm grass course. As they used to say in the old days, he likes to hear his feet rattle. So we sort of learned that California is where he belongs. He had sustained in his last start when he ran in the Shoemaker Mile. That was 2 years ago. He sustained a tendon injury. It was a small lesion, but still, those are, you know, you have to be very careful with those and bring them back very slowly if you plan on bringing him back, which we really hadn't. We'd had some interest in him as a stallion, in Argentina, and nothing really panned out. Either the price wasn't right or the people were it was minimal interest. And then we'd had some interest in him as what they call chasers, you know, going over jumps. He's just a big, big, beautiful, impressive horse. And I can't even recall the trainer's name, but there was a trainer back east who has a great reputation with those types and offered us a decent amount of money. But Bolo's group just decided, you know, hey, what the heck, let's just try to bring him back. So that's when we decided, you know, we had rehabbed him from the very beginning when he first sustained the injury. We had gone about doing, you know, everything right for him. We didn't just go, oh, he's got a tendon and just kick him out. We did some, you know, we did a lot of work on him. And he went out to Julie Adair's for several months. And she's just one of the best on the West Coast for taking excellent care of horses with leg problems. And we started a slow process of rehabilitation. We decided we weren't going to do anything with him for a year. I mean, we had a certain protocol that actually Dr. Wade Bird, who is our private vet here, suggested. And it's detailed, and I won't go into it. But it just, you know, it's kind of it's just a storybook how everything fell into place. And he came back and really was training great. And it was also difficult because now Santa Anita's surface is deep and slow, and it's probably not his favorite surface. So we were careful in his workouts. He didn't, you know, he wasn't extended in his workouts, just very long, slow, methodical workouts and gallops. And coming up to his first race, we were lucky to get an allowance race that he was eligible for. The distance was a bit too far off the layoff, but, you know, it was just a good opportunity to get him in a race. So we started him in that race at a mile and an eighth on the grass, and not really knowing, you know, often these horses after a long layoff like that don't really maybe come back with the same desire. So not really knowing, couldn't really judge that much in his training because we were being very careful with him. He was going to need the first start. So we were just hoping that he would come back with that killer instinct and wanting to do it again, but really didn't know until he left the starting gate. And then when he went to the lead and set every fraction at every single pole, we knew he was back. He did get a little late. My training showed up inside the 16th pole, but he was back. We knew he was back, and so that was great. He came out of that race in great shape and even showed more interest after that, so we knew it was game on again. And I mean, honestly, would I run him in a grade one off of that? Probably not. I might look for a softer spot, but that's all that was there. And he was ready to go, and we were concerned about him getting in because he hadn't had any recent earnings, and but there was a slot there for him, so we decided to take a shot.
Yeah, that was a shot well worth taking. In case you tuned in late, this is Jude Feld, and I'm visiting with trainer Carla Gaines on Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. So you took a shot, and the amazing happened. You won that race, and I remember watching you in the interview afterwards, and you had this glow on. I mean, that's a tremendous feeling, especially you told us earlier you love to take a horse that's never done anything that they've done before and teach him to do it. And now you've had this horse that was good, and then he wasn't so good, and then he was hurt, and now you bring him back 2 years later and he wins the Shoemaker Mile. I mean, that had to be just fantastic feeling.
Oh, it was, yeah, we were all just completely over the moon, for sure. And you know what, it's like everybody does this, you know, everybody, we all try to do the best we can as trainers, and the horses that we, you know, I mean, I love all of my horses. It doesn't matter what level they're at, but to be successful with a project like that is so rewarding. And because, hey, listen, you know, I'm no genius. I've done it with other horses that didn't get back. You know what I mean? So it's just, it's so wonderful when they actually go through the long process and get back to that level. It's, yeah, makes your heart sing for sure.
Yeah, when the plan comes together.
And he loves it. That's what he loves to do. So.
Well, that's why we do it, right? We do it for them, really. I mean, people don't understand that. They think, oh, you know, it's great. You win a grade one. You make a bunch of money and all. But it's not about any of that. It's just you want to do it for the horse because the horse wants to win. The horse wants to do it. And I think that's what a lot of people miss about our sport.
Right. Yeah, they don't really understand that. It's you know, I get that. It's hard for people to understand unless they've been a part of it. But once you've been a part of it, it's, you know, that song, it's like, you know, once the bug bites you, you learn to live with the sting.
It's true. Absolutely true. Well, let's talk about some of the other nice horses you've developed. Neshoba's Key, she was one of my favorites. I wrote a piece for her when she was in the Breeders' Cup about you and Joe Talamo. It's one of the one of my favorite things that I've ever written, and she was some kind of horse.
She really was, and she truly was. That was a tough thing that happened with her. But I remember taking, because she'd always only run on the synthetics. At that time, we had synthetic tracks, and she'd only run on synthetics and fast grass, and she was very, very effective on those surfaces. And then we go back to the Breeders' Cup, and it literally rained forever, and I was just having, you know, a meltdown every day, like, make it stop raining, you know?
Yeah.
And Mr. Williamson had brought his whole family, just like three generations of family members back for the race. And I, again, with Joe Talamo, I think he was still a bug then.
Yeah, he was calling you Miss Carla.
Yeah, right. He'd done such a tremendous job on her in so many races. I just couldn't take him off for a journeyman rider. I mean, maybe in hindsight, that's something I thought about it, but I just literally couldn't do it, to be honest. And he was only, I think he was only like 17 years old or something. But when I walked the turf course that morning, I put on my muckers and went out on the turf course and walked it. I was horrified because it was so deep on the rail. I mean, it was like halfway up my calf.
Mm-hmm.
So when we were in the paddock, I talked to Joe about it, and I said, look, just stay on the outside. Just get to the outside, and because it was so much different. It was less deep on the outside. I said, I don't care what. If you go 10 wide, no one is going to get mad at you. I'm concerned about the safety of the horse. And just don't get down on the rail. And then, you know, they broke from the gate, and the guys just pushed him right down on the rail. So he didn't get out. I don't even remember where it was, but it was after the quarter pole that he was finally able to maneuver his way out, and she came flying, but not good enough to win. She finished fourth, and that was that.
She was something else. I remember that day. I was in the paddock doing paddock reports. On the radio, and I was so soaked at the end of the day. I mean, my clothes, I had to wring them out in the bathtub when I got back to the hotel. I was just absolutely drenched, and there was nothing you could do. The tree at Monmouth kept me relatively dry for a long, long time, and I always say hello to that tree when I go back to Monmouth and thank him for taking care of me that day, because that was like, oh, that was brutal. So
it really was. Yeah. I was so nervous, just because, and only because of her safety. You know, I just didn't want her getting injured. So,
Well, you won the Breeders' Cup Sprint in 2009 with Dancing in Silks. That had to be a fun day.
Oh, and that's another funny story, because I honestly, if I'm going to just throw it out there, I just the owner of that horse, he was, you know, he wasn't very well. He didn't have a lot of money, but he wanted to run in the Breeders' Cup, and the horse wasn't even nominated, you know. And at that, in that year, I mean, there were some really good sprinters. God, I mean, I can't remember the horse's name. That was it, Godolphin? What a horse! Ignorant here, sorry, but my memory is fading. But at any rate, I said 100. He had to supplement 160,000. I tried to talk him out of it. I'm more concerned about his pocketbook than me running a horse in the sprint like a bonehead. But at any rate, we put the money up and got the job done. So that was unbelievable. I think he was 20-1 or something, 25-1.
It's a lot of pressure when you have to supplement for a big amount of money. You just want to make sure the horse earns it back. And if racing in the Breeders' Cup isn't stressful enough, then you got that hanging over your head as well.
Exactly. So I'm glad he did it now.
Yeah. Well, it's always scary, but if you got the right horse, it's okay. It's a good thing to do. It must be nice having that trophy on the mantle.
It is.
You mentioned Temple City earlier, and you trained him, and he's gone on to be such a nice stallion. It must be enjoyable to have a son of Temple City that is so talented after training him yourself.
Yeah, it's super. Like with Temple City, again, that was a horse that he didn't start till later in his career because he had a multitude of problems. And I was just, you know, I guess lucky that Spendthrift sent him to me. And he just missed winning a grade one himself just by like a nose. But he was a super horse. He was difficult. He was a typical Dynaformer. Very, very hot-blooded, and he had his moments, but ended up having a great career. So very, very late in life. I don't even think he started till late threes. I can't remember, maybe early four.
Well,
that was fun. Nice horse. Beautiful horse. One of the prettiest Dynaformers I've ever seen.
Yeah, he's a great-looking horse. Of course, he's famous in my family for siring Miss Temple City. My brother bred her, and she gave us a lot of thrills and many glasses of champagne. So.
Yeah, she was an amazing racehorse. Yeah, so amazing.
She could run. So very, very, very happy with Temple City. And then you trained a horse that I used to love because of my dad's initials. His initials were JH, and you trained Lucky JH, who was a favorite of mine.
Yeah, he was another horse that was just such a competitor. And, you know, after his career, Mr. Harris actually stood him at stud for a while, and he produced some nice horses. His stud career was limited because he ended up having just internal problems that, you know, I think he went to Davis and lived at Davis a while, and they ended up having to put him, you know, to sleep because of, I don't really recall now, but it was something that they just could never really correct. And yeah, it was sad. But you know, had he been around for a while longer, I think he would have produced some nice cow, a lot of nice cowbreds.
Yeah, he was a good horse. Let's talk a minute about Mr. Harris and Mr. Williamson, and they've been huge supporters of you the whole time you've been training. Talk about those guys and how, you know, they still support you today.
Well, I mean, they basically, you know, I met them through the sales, like Mr. Harris and Mr. Williamson, and then when I decided to go out on my own, I mean, that's the loyalty aspect that often you don't see much anymore in this industry, but they gave me my first two horses, literally. Mr. Harris gave me my first horse, and Mr. Williamson gave me my second horse, and we won't say how many decades that was ago, but I'm still training, you know, still training for, well, Mr. Williamson, unfortunately, has left this good earth, so he's no longer with us, and a lot of his bloodstock has been sold off, and I don't think his son right now is real happy with the situation at Santa Anita, so I actually don't have any horses for the Williamsons right now, but hopefully in the future I will. They don't have a lot right now in training, and Henry, his son, really prefers training on the synthetic track up north, so I know he's got a few horses up there. But through the years, Mr. Williamson and I had so many wonderful, wonderful times in racing. It's been my life. I mean, my career basically has been based on those two single individuals, Mr. Harris and Mr. Williamson, for sure. I mean, that's a long time to be together.
Yeah.
It's been wonderful. It really has. It's been a great ride.
Yeah, it's nice when you have people like that back you, and no matter what happens, they're in your corner. That's always good. I always like to ask trainers, who's the horse that you did an amazing training job with that nobody knows about but you?
That's a good question. I don't know that I'm amazing, but
you're pretty amazing.
Amazing, and they happen to fall into our hands somehow, you know. But gosh, I don't know. I'd have to think about that. I'm not really.
All right.
Yeah.
It's one of those things where, you know, sometimes you know you did a great job, even though nobody else, not a famous horse or anything, you know, just some horse kicking around that you know, wow, I did a really good job with that horse. When you go to bed at night, you go, man, that was pretty good. I do know what I'm doing.
I do know what I'm doing. Well, you know, we do work with a lot of California bred horses here, so. There's probably been numerous ones. They, you know, sometimes they need a little special attention, and you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It wouldn't really be well known that those horses, each one is treated pretty individually here. We never had a really big, big, big stable. I mean, at one stage we were maybe up to 60 horses, but generally we keep it, you know. Right now, we're probably down to 28, 30 horses. But generally, we kept usually between 40 and 50 horses. So, you know, it gives you a little more time.
Right. A little more individualized care kind of thing.
Yeah.
Do you have any races on the bucket list? I mean, you keep saying how old you are. So I don't want to insult you with the bucket list question. But
when people start asking me, how long have you been training? And I actually say it. I'm like, man, that's a long time.
You bet you started
young. You know
what?
Young. Yeah. Breeders' Cup races, bring them on. The Derby. Yeah. But it's like the Derby, it's never been something that, oh, my gosh, I've got to win that before my career ends, or it just wouldn't be the same. But I would still like to win it. You know what I mean?
Sure. Sure.
I just love, you know, probably my favorite thing in the world is I would love to have 200 two-year-olds. I mean, I just love young horses. I love developing young horses and working with them. They're kind of my kids.
It's always exciting when you get them in too, because they're like a blank canvas, you know.
Yeah.
You get to paint them any way you want, so.
Yeah,
it's so much fun.
Very much so.
So much fun. So when you're not at the track, which is probably rare, what are the things you like to do?
I used to be a runner. I love running. I love hiking. I've kind of slowed down on the running these days just due to I've had some problems with my feet. But hiking, I love hiking. Probably at the top of the list is skiing. I love snow skiing is one of my most favorite sports. I love the outdoors. Anything to do with the outdoors, water skiing, snow skiing. I love working out. That would probably be the top of my list. probably something I don't get to do as much as I would like is travel. I love travel.
Yeah,
being love
a,
it.
Being a horse trainer.
And I used to do a lot of traveling, you know, buying horses, going to Europe and buying horses, and I just so enjoyed that. I haven't done that so much lately, but yeah, I think just anything outdoors, the beach, love the beach, love running on the beach, walking on the beach, that sort of stuff.
Is
you
have
to do stuff that you can find time to do after you leave the barn.
Yeah, right. Yeah, you got to have a little mental break, I think. Is Del Mar your favorite place to go?
Yes, absolutely. Yes, definitely.
like hanging out in the sand?
I mean, here, like being in Southern California, when we have a good year of snow, we have local ski areas that, you know, we'll take an afternoon and a day off and ski for, you know, that during that time. And it's such, and we can even go for a day after training. We do that a lot to go up to Big Bear and ski for a half day. And that's like getting away from Los Angeles. It's so close, but you feel like you're, you know, thousands of miles away. So,
yeah, that's what I always tell people. It's the only place you can go skiing in the morning and surfing in the afternoon if you want to. I mean, it's incredible.
I know, it's crazy, but it's true. It's very true.
Yeah. So my daughter Ryan would not forgive me if I didn't ask about the internet sensation Louis Gaines.
I know, right? You know he hasn't been well.
I know. I know.
Yeah, he's doing better. Yeah, somehow he sustained a staph infection in an elbow joint, which is, you know, can be deadly. He's still on antibiotics, and he's walking now. I mean, for a while he couldn't even walk, so that's improved. And we have him out at a friend of mine's house right now. She's got this beautiful pool and jacuzzi, and he's just a real water baby. Like he'd rather swim than do anything. So it's really inspired him, and he's having his water therapy, I should say, or his swimming therapy right now, and he's improving every day. It's small steps, but he is improving. So tell her and everybody else, thanks for thinking of him. Because that's my other kid, along with the horses.
In case you don't know who Louis Gaines is, that's Carla's dog, and he's very famous in Southern California. He's on the web all the time.
Yeah, it's pretty funny. He's done commercials on the local channels in San Diego, and he's done TVG, you know, videos, and yeah, he has quite a following on Facebook. So it's pretty cool. It really is. He's a great dog.
Yeah. Well, the picture that you had posted of him, he looks like he's very happy currently. So I'm glad that he's kind of turning the corner and things are going good for him, because he has such a legion of fans.
So it's pretty, you know, when we had Breeders' Cup at Del Mar last, whatever year it was, I mean, I had horses down there, and I would just literally just be walking back and forth to the barn, and I can't tell you how many times I was stopped by people I didn't know, and they were from all parts of the world.
Yeah.
You know, like photographers, and, you know, and they would like, excuse me, is that Louis Gaines? Like, you know, who are you? Well, who I was really didn't matter. And yeah. They would go, oh, could I please get a photograph with him? Like, sure.
Selfies with Louis. Well,
selfie with Louis, yeah.
This hour just flew by, and I thank you a lot for taking the time to hang out with us this evening. Special thank you to Lee Delapina, our talented producer, for keeping us in line and on time. And I want to remind everybody, tune into the Equine Forum, the show that launched the network, this and every Saturday morning, 8 a.m. Eastern Time on Sirius 219, XM 201, and streaming live on our website, horseracingradio.net. This is Jude Feld from our Jimmy Johns of Lexington, Kentucky studios. Good night, everybody.